President Xi Jinping stands at the apex of power in the People's Republic of China. Since his appointment as General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party in 2012, he has progressively consolidated his control over the Chinese state, economy, and armed forces. Yet the consequences of Xi's ascendancy for China and the world are difficult to assess. Is he an ideologically driven radical, hell-bent on dismantling a Western-led world order, or an arch pragmatist committed to his own political survival? And how does he conceive of China's role in a new age of great power rivalry? I'm Jack Dickens, commissioning editor at Engelsberg Ideas. With me to examine Xi Jinping and his worldview is Rana Mitter, ST Lee Professor of US-Asia Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School and a fellow of the British Academy. Welcome to the podcast, Rana.
Jack, lovely to be with you.
So, Rana, you're someone who's devoted a lot of time to studying Chinese history and to trying to understand how Chinese leaders, past and present, think about the world. Just how challenging has it been for you to try and get inside the mind of President Xi Jinping?
Jack, I think there's a case to be made that Xi Jinping may be the single most unknowable of the major global leaders in the world today. I mean, the mind of President Trump is perhaps in some ways not that hard to divine because, of course, he sends out his personal thoughts on social media, regularly, several times a day. And although Vladimir Putin doesn't do quite that, I think it's fair to say that he's made lots of speeches. He engages in sort of the kind of very, very black humor of his back and forth with journalists as he sort of moves in trying to tease them and trying to dominate them. We have a sense of what his personality really is. Xi Jinping doesn't do any of that. Xi Jinping certainly doesn't josh with journalists. In fact, I think there's only one record that I know of his ever having made a joke. And in case you want that for the record, that was at a summit, which was, I think, at the invitation of President Obama in the early 2010s. He was in America. And he said, many people have told me that they think Americans think that Chinese politics is like the TV show House of Cards, but that's really not true. And when I say joke, it's more like a pleasantry, but it's one of the very few occasions that we know of that he said anything along those lines. But aside from that, the most common pose that we see is that very familiar slight smile. Doesn't seem to give anything very much away. He's a man who always looks, you know, pretty comfortable, pretty confident, but gives almost nothing away in terms of facial expression, turn of phrase in his language. A very, very difficult man to figure out.
I think, as you say, there is this mystery surrounding him because on the one hand, he seems to hold this supreme power over a vast country, but he isn't always expressing his opinions. He isn't very scrutable. He isn't, like you say, always offering his innermost thoughts on social media. Is this a carefully cultivated mystique? Is this part of how he exercises power?
I think it is. I don't think there's a sense in which Xi Jinping does anything by accident. And I think that also it's partly psychological. I know that as we take this conversation forward, Jack, we're going to be talking in more detail about Xi's childhood, his time as a young man. But also, I think it's worth noting up front that this is a man who is very reserved, very cautious. And I think in part that's because of the trauma that shaped him in his childhood and teen days. We'll talk more about what happened then, but essentially I think that experience has made him someone who never wants to be out of control, always wants to know what's going on, always wants to be in control of himself. And I think the cultivation of his image today as someone calm, collected, rational, but very, very difficult to either whip into a rage or to make laugh or react in a very emotional way, I think that has been cultivated very, very specifically over time.
Okay, so I think it's perhaps best to start at the beginning. Xi Jinping was born in 1953. Can you tell us about what was going on in China in the 1950s? What kind of world was he born into?
Xi Jinping was born at one of the most transformational moments in the history of modern China. And I should say that modern China has had many very transformational moments, so that's quite a high bar to leap. But he was born just 4 years after the establishment of the People's Republic of China in 1949, which is the communist state that, of course, still is very much with us today in a rather different form. He was the inheritor, China was the inheritor, really, of half a century or more at that point of wars and revolutions, starting from the repeated invasions and incursions by Western countries in the late 19th century. Japan was the big attacking force in much of the mid-20th century. China had gone just, you know, less than a decade before through one of the most devastating experiences of the century, the 8 years of what in China they call the War of Resistance, but we know as World War II. For China, between 1937 and 1945, killing millions of people, turning tens of millions into refugees. So when that war also made it more possible to create an ecology, a sort of literally scorched earth in some cases, that brought the communists to power in 1949 under their charismatic, ruthless, dangerous leader, Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao. This was a moment in which China turned in a completely different direction from what it had had before. I think it's an exaggeration to say that China was ever pro-Western in a full sense in the early 20th century. It was, you know, pro-China more than anything else. But China's nationalists, their leaders, had oriented more towards the US. That all changed after 1949, when the Soviet Union was the guiding star for China, China becoming the second player in the constellation of socialist states around the world. And amongst the top leaders who sat there in Zhongnanhai, the equivalent to the Kremlin, the Forbidden City's most hidden areas, then and now, where the top leaders of China live, along with Mao and some of the figures at the time who perhaps were in the top tier, Liu Shaoqi, you know, essentially in Mao's number two, Peng Dehuai, one of the great generals of that time, Lin Biao, who would go on to become Mao's successor. There was also a man, not quite at that level, but certainly very high up, named Xi Zhongxun. And his first name, as we say in Chinese, his surname, as we'd say in English, Xi, is of course relevant because he was the father of Xi Jinping. He was also one of the many grizzled warriors who had, you know, made their way through the harsh, lowest soil of northwest China to essentially go on that very long journey, the long march, you might say, to ultimate communist victory. And in 1949, he and his fellow party members were given that chance to establish this new socialist command economy, the People's Republic of China. And 4 years after the establishment of Mao's state, the son, Jinping, was born in 1953. Not an only child, a part of a set of siblings, but as we know now, he would go on, obviously, to become a deeply significant global figure. So that was the China which Xi Jinping was born into.
So Xi's background as the son of a prominent Communist Party official, a member of Mao's inner circle, means that he's often described and identified as a princeling. Can you explain what that means and what its significance is in China's political culture?
Yes. I mean, the term princeling obviously is ironic, both in Chinese and, I guess, by extension, in English. Essentially, it's a statement that heredity, your genetic link to a prominent party member, is what gives you prominence in your own right. In other words, that if Xi's surname hadn't been Xi, or in the case of other figures who come through that sort of bloodline, if they'd not been related, then they might not have risen to the top. I mean, that may or may not be the case, we will never fully know, but it's certainly what people say. So the term princeling, though, rather than just, you know, kind of a nepo baby or whatever expression we might use, has another implication, which is a similarity with the system that China had before 1911. In other words, before the revolution that overthrew the last emperor. Because for 2,000 years or more, really, China was ruled by a succession of dynasties, and each one generally became notorious for the way in which factionalism at the royal court would see various princes, their families, vie for power. In other words, to take over the throne of the emperor. Now, obviously, the Chinese Communist Party, and we'll talk more about this, is not an imperial court. It sometimes behaves like one, but it is also a Marxist-Leninist party that has a very strong modern political identity. But when people see, for instance, the children of top Chinese officials, and when I say children, usually sons, coming to prominence, this ironic term princeling, little prince, is used to describe how they may have got to that particular position and how they're perceived in that wider political sphere.
Okay, so I wondered whether you could tell us about some of the benefits of being a princeling in the 1950s and 1960s. Do we have much of a sense of, you know, what his education would have been like, which school he went to, and what he would have learned about China and the world at that time?
Xi Jinping grew up under extraordinarily privileged circumstances, at least for the first near decade of his life. He grew up essentially in those compounds, as I mentioned, in central Beijing, around the children of other top officials. His father was a very senior figure in the new communist government. And as a result, Xi Jinping had access to great accommodations, educational opportunities, and, you know, day-to-day play companions, who I guess would have been, you know, very much also from that privileged rank. It's worth noting that because of what happens to him next. I mean, not to spoil the story too much, but his circumstances change very, very suddenly and very, very brutally from his point of view. But that early few years was very much one in which he received great privilege because he was the son of one of the People's Republic of China's absolutely, you know, top and most respected leaders.
And as you allude to there, his world is upended quite dramatically in the 1960s, first when his father is purged, but then from the onset of the Cultural Revolution. Can you tell us about these events and how they affected him?
Yes. So the Cultural Revolution, which we'll come back to, is probably, to those who don't spend a lot of time looking at China, the most famous cataclysmic event of the Mao era. And of course, through books such as Wild Swans or Life and Death in Shanghai, or, you know, scholarly volumes such as Mao's Last Revolution by Roderick McFarquhar and Michael Schoenhaus, which is one of the perhaps the definitive English language elite account of the Cultural Revolution, we know quite what a destructive, inward-looking period of, you know, madness is perhaps not too harsh a word to use, that it was. But that wasn't the point at which Xi Jinping's troubles began. That had begun earlier. Actually, in the early 1960s, and particularly around 1962, there's a period known as the Socialist Education Campaign. Purges, which were always part and are always part of the Chinese Communist Party's modus operandi. I mean, recording this at the very end of January 2026, Jack, and in the last week that we've been speaking of, China's top military leader, Zhang Youxia, has just been fired and accused of, you know, corruption and all sorts of other things with almost no warning out of the blue. So what happens in the 1960s is not so far sometimes what happens in the 2020s. But let's stick with the 60s for the moment. So there's a particular incident. I won't go too far into the nerdy weeds, but just a little bit to give an idea of the kind of thing that could get people into trouble. There's an incident with Xi Zhongxun, with Xi Jinping's father. He's a high-up official by that stage, and he gets basically in one of his roles as a sort of what we call a propaganda surveiller. It's not quite the right way to phrase it, but I don't want to go too far into the technical terms. But he gets a request for permission to publish, not for him, but for someone else to publish a novel. Well, novel, great stuff, you know, sit back and maybe get a cocktail on the beach and have a kind of rip-roaring read. Not that sort of novel. This is essentially a likely fictionalized version of a true story. And the true story is about a man named Liu Zhidan. Liu Zhidan is not a very famous communist leader, unless you happen to be hanging around in Shanxi province in the 1930s. But to those in the know, he's very significant. Because, again, simplifying wildly, many people at the time thought that he might be a contender to go to the very top. He died young, perhaps fortunately from the point of view of Mao and other people who did get to the top. But his sort of legend remained, and it was always assumed that he'd been quite instrumental in the early career of Xi Jinping in certain ways. So Xi Jinping is sort of faced with a bit of a dilemma when asked whether he can authorize a publication of a very frank and in some ways quite sort of troublesome account of, you know, what Liu Zhidan really said and what he did and what he thought. Again, in lightly fictionalized form, but not really very much. And he hums and haws and keeps sending it back for revision and revision. But after some unfeasible number of revisions, he either has to sort of say yes or no. And very reluctantly, he says yes. And all hell breaks loose. Essentially, I think at the end of the party congress that year, he's rounded up and arrested and basically put under interrogation for trying to subvert Mao. Now, of course, he's not, well, we can't know what's in his mind, really. But there's no evidence that we have from the outside that he was really trying to subvert the system. But the details of all of these astonishingly complex affairs are in one of the very best biographies that's been written in recent years, which is called The Party's Interests Always Come First by Joseph Terigian of the Hoover Institution in the US. And it is a life of Xi Jinping, the father, but it has lots of insight into Xi Jinping as well. So that book is an absolute must read on this subject. Anyway, fascinating as the father is, let's stick to the son. Essentially, this is the moment that throws the family into turmoil. Xi Jinping is arrested and, you know, disappears for years, basically. Doesn't really reappear until the early 70s. His mother, Xi Jinping's mother, Xi Jinping's wife, is also, you know, forced into confessions and is separated from much of the family. The kids are separated, different parts of China. And Xi Jinping, keep your eye following that ball, is sent out to the countryside, really, in Shanxi province, where he is, you know, living in pretty brutal circumstances. You know, this is someone who has grown up in the most privileged background in Beijing, you know, great education, great circumstances. And now he's basically kind of doing agricultural work out in the countryside. The education stops, basically. Some basic reading and so forth. Even today, you can notice, and again, I'm psychologizing slightly here, but indulge me, when Xi Jinping goes to a foreign country, when he goes to Russia, when he goes to the UK, quite often in his opening remarks, his speechwriter, but presumably with his, you know, permission, puts in a few references to literary classics. This is, I think, a reminder, in one sense, of what he was missing for all those years. It's perhaps almost a kind of nostalgia for something that never happened, that, you know, in another life, he would have stayed in Beijing, getting education at a top university or top high school and then university in his teens and reading all these masterpieces. And I guess he may have made up for lost time later. There was one story that was told actually on a Chinese TV show. I don't know if it's true or not, but, you know, it was on Chinese TV. So let's put it out there. It's been in the public domain about Xi Jinping, that he had heard there was a book in a neighboring village to where he was in exile. Neighboring is pushing it a bit, because I think it was about 7 miles away or something. It's not an easy stroll. But he'd heard there was a book there. So he made, you know, the trek all the way and got it and brought it back and read it, and then went back and took it back again. That book was Goethe's Faust. Now imagine the symbolism of Xi Jinping reading one of the great artistic works of the Western tradition on the role of fate, destiny, making choices, and the moral freight that comes around those as well. One of the reasons why it sounds almost a bit too good to be true, but as I say, at least at some point in Chinese media that was put around. So this is a time when Xi Jinping essentially is deeply unhappy. He said that himself. There's no great secret about that. Taken from one of the most comfortable circumstances you can imagine in China and thrust out into the countryside.
So what is he doing mostly when he's in the countryside during the Cultural Revolution period? Is he sort of toiling on the earth with Chinese peasants? Is he, like you said, does he have much time to read books and to sort of expand his mind?
Not always entirely clear. I mean, he wasn't keeping diary. Well, if he kept diaries at the time, then I guess they haven't come through to researchers. The interviews he's given, and over time, you know, there have been bits of information leaked out that gives some indication of where he, you know, what he was up to. There seems to be an agricultural labor, and he's spoken in the past of how his sympathy for China's peasants comes in part because of having at least, you know, seen their circumstances. I think there's a general trend, and this is more about his cohort group than about Xi Jinping himself, that by definition, young children, I mean, we're talking about not even reaching teenage age by the time he was sent away. And then, of course, he gets to teenage years during that time. From a pampered background in the city, I mean, how useful are they going to be in agricultural work outside? There are stories over and over again of youths who are sent down to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution, who the peasants sort of regarded as hungry mouths to feed with zero economic value because they didn't know anything about farming, didn't know anything about how to work in these harsh conditions outside, but they needed to be fed, even so. Now, I don't know that that was specifically the case with Xi Jinping, but one could imagine that it wasn't really something that was in his toolkit. In terms of, you know, having opportunities for education, reading, well, the impression we get is no, not really. I mean, as I say, if you hear rumours there's one book in a village 7 miles away and you're willing to kind of spend the day presumably going to actually get it, it doesn't suggest a wide range of possibilities. I think certainly compared to today, we're talking about, you know, well over half a century later, the absolute impoverishment of much of the Chinese countryside has to be remembered, not just because China just was a very poor country at that time, but also, of course, the period we're talking about, the early 1960s to mid-1960s, is literally just at the end of one of the most devastating events. I keep going, coming back to them, but there are a lot of them in modern Chinese history. The Great Leap Forward of 1958 to 62, an experiment, allegedly, in agricultural production that went horribly wrong, and which the Communist Party refused to acknowledge had gone horribly wrong. So at the same time that, thanks to deeply foolish and malicious, really, in some cases, decisions on what crops to grow, which went wrong, leading to, you know, mass crop failure, instead of prioritizing feeding the peasants in the countryside, what grain there was taken and exported to the Soviet Union. And we now know that, you know, certainly tens of millions of Chinese seem to have starved to death during that period. I say seem to have because it's weird but not coincidental that this is one of the very few major disasters in world history, let alone Chinese history, where there are no photographs that anyone knows of. There are no pictures of peasants dying out in the countryside. They probably exist, perhaps, you know, locked up in some archive somewhere in Beijing. You can see pictures of famines in China for the 1940s. We all know that in the 1980s, British consciences were pricked by seeing television pictures of the Ethiopian famine. There are no pictures that I know of the Great Leap Forward, but that doesn't mean it wasn't real. And that doesn't mean that people like Peng Dehuai, who was one of the top leaders who went down to the countryside, to the villages near where he lived, couldn't see that the peasants were starving. And eventually, although he was purged for talking about it, which made everyone else sit up straight, eventually by 1962, the policies had become so destructive that they had to be ended. And that was the countryside into which Xi Jinping, that stage, I think, we're talking about 9, 10 years old, is thrust in the second phase of his life.
So we often think of different political generations as being shaped by formative events and experiences. Do these traumatic events and these disasters, such as the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, leave a lasting impression on Xi Jinping's character and worldview?
I think they did. I think, first of all, the experience of being plucked from his, you know, comfortable life and plunged into the countryside. And then, you know, a few years after that initial forced removal, the fact that the entire country in 1966 burst out into the Cultural Revolution was a deeply traumatic set of experiences for him. And I think that, amongst other things, it has fed into his personality in terms of his obsession with control. You know, that's one of the things that we see over and over again. People often compare him to Mao. And certainly in terms of his, you know, overall drive to power and to, you know, raise China's place in the world, there are many similarities. But one difference is that Mao loved chaos. Indeed, he invented the Cultural Revolution as a result of that. He loved to overturn things from the grassroots and bring the high low and raise the low high, keeping himself at the top of the time, of course. But anyone else in power was fair game. Xi Jinping doesn't do that and has never done that. And even though, of course, he is very, very much someone who kind of purges people without warning or, you know, changes leadership, he's very keen to make sure that doesn't spread into any kind of mass movement. And I think that's largely because he associates mass movements with the Cultural Revolution. That's what happens when you let the virus into society and let the masses just do exactly what they want. Not everyone in his generation or cognate generations felt the same way. Hu Yaobang, who ended up as one of the relatively most liberal Chinese communist leaders, also suffered greatly during the Cultural Revolution, as all of that generation did. And the lesson he took was that China must liberalize much more strongly. One of the reasons that Hu Yaobang was purged in 1987 by Deng Xiaoping, the successor leader to Mao. Xi Jinping never went in that direction. Again, it seems counterintuitive in some ways, but maybe it's not, that despite the fact the Cultural Revolution caused by the party had caused him such personal destruction and also his family, he nonetheless doubled down on wanting to actually enter the Communist Party and rise within it. But with him, he took and has taken and takes with him today, I think to this day, that fear of the Chinese word luan, chaos, which is what he associates with that Cultural Revolution period.
So as you mentioned, he joins the Communist Party in the 1970s.
But not in the first try. Xi Jinping, I think, had to apply, I want to say, 7 times for membership of the Communist Party before he got in, because he was turned down the first 6 times.
I was doing some research on this and I saw varying reports. Something between 5 to 10 times seems to be the consensus.
Yes, but certainly not on the first go.
Okay, certainly not on the first go indeed. So he eventually gets into the Communist Party in the 1970s, after trying many times. And the Cultural Revolution, of course, exhausts itself and is finally brought to an end after Mao's death in 1976. Can you tell us about what Xi Jinping did next?
Well, first of all, let me just give you one more sketch. And this is, again, from Joseph Terygian's brilliant book, but I think it's such an indicative moment. But it gives you an idea of what kind of person Xi Jinping was at the end of the Cultural Revolution in the early 1970s, when he's beginning to move from teendom into manhood, maturity, and his communist career. So we're talking about, I can't remember the exact date. I'm not sure we have an exact date, but it's early to mid-1970s when Xi is in his early 20s. And he's reunited with his father. Remember, he hasn't seen him for years. And all accounts are that Xi Jinping's father was an extremely strict and unemotional sort of man, a martinet, you might say. And when junior Xi Jinping met Xi Jinping at this meeting in the early 70s, the younger man, Xi Jinping, was smoking a cigarette. And by the way, this is indicative because people, there are rumors around, there are always rumors about everything that Xi Jinping dearly loves a gasp, you know, likes to have a quick smoke even today, but of course he would never do it in public. I have no idea whether this is true or not, but you know, it's just out there as a rumor. But at that point, he was apparently, you know, smoking a cigarette, pretty commonplace in the 70s anyway. But even so, his father was not happy about this and said, "Why are you smoking?" And Xi Jinping, at least in accounts given to us, said, "I'm smoking because I'm depressed because of what's happened to our family." He didn't quite say because of you, but he might as well have done. And it appears his father was slightly taken aback. And apparently his father paused, didn't say anything for a few seconds, and then looked at him and said, "I give you permission to smoke." And there's a coda to the story as well, which is that apparently a few weeks later, when they meet again, Xi Jinping has a present for Xi Jinping. He hands it over. It's a pipe, so he can smoke tobacco with a pipe rather than with cigarettes. There's a lot packed up in that, and we can't entirely know precisely, you know, what the motivations was. But the idea of Xi Jinping as vulnerable, as this sort of youngish man who is still terrified by the thought of meeting this father who he worships, but is also clearly greatly in awe of, at a liminal moment for China and for Xi Jinping's future. You know, he doesn't know then, none of us can know then, that he's going to become the Xi Jinping that we know today. And so it's that uncertain man, chain smoking, switching to the pipe that his father originally disapproved of in terms of his smoking, but then, you know, gave over to him, who enters the pathway to success in politics in China. And what does he do next? Well, actually, in some ways, the milestones that he goes through are ones that would look very familiar even today. You might say he was one of the first people to undertake what is the kind of standard path to bureaucratic success or political success through the bureaucracy in China. He was given the circumstances, the wherewithal, to go and study at Tsinghua University, one of the top universities in China, very science-oriented. And today, in the 2020s, Tsinghua has quite a privileged position in Chinese life because it's Xi Jinping's old university. So he went there. And then he, as we mentioned, he managed to get himself into the Communist Party. So he starts to undertake this sort of cursus honorum, this sort of path of increasingly significant appointments. There are quite a few of them in different cities and provinces. The one that people come back to over and over again, and we're kind of, you know, heading through the 80s and into the 1990s, is that he becomes the party secretary of Zhejiang province. And Zhejiang on China's eastern seaboard, then and now, is a real sort of up-and-coming kind of place. Ironically, it's a place that's very entrepreneurial. Amongst other great cities, it has the city of Hangzhou, which many people will know is the birthplace of Alibaba, China's biggest retailer and, you know, one of the biggest retail companies and online retailers in the world. But it's also, I mean, that was to come later in the 21st century. But in terms of the establishment of this new market socialist world that Deng Xiaoping unleashed on China, Zhejiang was at the heart of the action. And bearing in mind that the KPIs, the key performance indicators that Chinese officials then and now had, were very, very much tied up to economic growth. If you wanted to be seen as a successful leader who was going to go further, you needed to generate economic growth within your region and your area. And it would appear that, you know, no doubt not merely as a sort of solo enterprise, but in a sort of collective set of activities through his leadership of the party in the province, that Zhejiang province was going gangbusters, a great success story, and that Xi Jinping over time moved up and up and up, both through the geographical kind of range of places to be appointed, but also more and more significantly in the party itself. We should add, by the way, ironically, that Zhejiang province was, amongst other things, the birthplace of Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist leader of China before the communists, who was actually defeated by Mao and had to flee to Taiwan. But I suspect that's a connection which isn't much mentioned by the communist leadership in Zhejiang itself.
So his period governing in Zhejiang is very interesting, because we often think of Xi Jinping now as wanting to assert more control over private enterprise and the private sector in China. But it seems that he was part of this, very much part of this opening up and reforming project. under Mao successors such as Deng Xiaoping and those who came after him. So do we know how he himself interprets this period in Chinese history in the 80s and 90s? What does he think about private enterprise and capitalism and his own role in pioneering a Chinese version of it?
The short answer, as far as I'm aware, Jack, is no, we don't know that much directly because, as you know, we've been saying throughout this discussion, he's a man who keeps himself to himself in many ways. It really takes a lot of hard work and digging to get any sense of what he really thinks about a whole variety of issues. But we do have witnesses from that time, some of them actually very much from the Western world. So bearing in mind the sort of blossoming of Zhejiang comes in the 1990s and I suppose early 2000s. This is around the time when China enters the World Trade Organization again with American support and sponsorship. And the market economics, which is brought to a shuddering halt in 1989 because of Tiananmen Square and the killings of students and protesters, then sort of gets a second start in the 1990s and China begins to take off with its, you know, extraordinary economic growth during that period. And Zhejiang, along with other eastern Chinese provinces, is at the heart of that growth. What does it do? So my guess is that at least two strands of thought crystallize in Xi Jinping's mind at that time. Number one is that economic growth is central to the success of any other political project. And he can see how much, you know, the increase in tax revenues, for instance, becomes very important. 1994 is the year of one of the major tax reforms in China in which, you know, more income begins to come to the center. And so you can see how the success of very entrepreneurial Chinese provinces is able to generate income that can also fuel, you know, what you might call the federal government. That's an American term. That's not the right way to put it, but the central government in China. But I suspect that he also at this point begins to see what happens if this sort of market growth is untrammeled, in his view. In other words, the need to for the party to control what's going on and making sure that actually, while market socialism is allowed to develop and create wealth for China, that it must be brought under political control. One person who saw Xi Jinping during that time, and who I've talked to for another interview a few years ago, is Robert Zoellick, Bob Zoellick, who was president of the World Bank eventually. And at that point, as an American financial official, he visited Xi Jinping, I think maybe more than once, actually, maybe twice during that time. Obviously, at that point, it was not immediately clear that Xi Jinping was going to become the supreme leader. But Zoellick, I think, has, you know, spoken about how he seemed to be articulate, impressive, you know, someone who was clearly on top of his brief. So we don't have, as far as I'm aware, much inside knowledge of his thinking, but we do have that first phase of witnesses from outside noticing this now middle-aged man, I guess, beginning to go places at that stage.
So obviously the 1980s, the 1990s and the 2000s are a period of extraordinary economic transformation. But I just want to pick up on what you said briefly about the Tiananmen Square massacre. This was obviously a major event in global history at the time. The world was watching. It caused a crisis within the Chinese Communist Party itself. How does Xi interpret those events?
I don't know that we have anything directly from Xi at the time. And again, of course, that would have been a much earlier phase of his life. And I don't think he's reflected on it directly since, because, you know, reminiscences and discussion of 1989 is not something that's really permissible in contemporary Chinese political culture. I think his view of it would be probably the same as actually most top leaders in the party, which is that it was an example of kind of liberalism gone wrong, allowing too much leeway to interest groups in China to have their say, can spiral into demonstrations and ultimately, you know, the potential destabilization of the party. I think it's notable, for instance, that something that did happen on Xi Jinping's watch, the imposition of the national security law in Hong Kong, came off the back of mass demonstrations in that city as well. And was 1989 in the mind of Xi Jinping when he clamped down on Hong Kong in 2020? I can't say directly, but it seems to me that the parallel would have probably been there. And of course, that now it is essentially illegal in Hong Kong to commemorate 1989 in a way that was not true at all. It was very publicly commemorated all the way until 2020.
So the Tiananmen massacre took place in June of 1989. But of course, there's another event for which 1989 is famous, and that happened in November, and it's the fall of the Berlin Wall. Do we have any indication of what Xi thinks about the fall of the Soviet Union?
Yes, we do. And this has become actually one of the best known stories about Xi Jinping, but I think that doesn't rob it of its importance or indeed authenticity, which was that as 1989 gave way to the early 90s and what we now know was the collapse of the Soviet Union under the rulership of Mikhail Gorbachev as General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, there was profound and very, very worried and concerned debate within the Chinese leadership about whether China might be next, not least because of what had happened in June 1989 in Beijing. And one of the most famous lines that emerged from these debates was from Xi Jinping himself, now beginning to come to prominence, in which he said, "What a shame that there was no real man who could stand up and save the party." And I think that that's a really interesting phrase, because not only is it, of course, about a sense that the most important thing would have been to save the party and use whatever means, I mean, the implication, but not a very difficult implication to work out, that violent reaction, as in the Tiananmen massacre of 1989, would have saved the Soviet Union. I don't think anyone who actually analyzes the Soviet Union thinks that would have been the case, because the internal weakness of the structures was far greater than it was in China at the time, as it turned out. But also that phrase, you know, the equivalent phrase of real man, there is a sort of masculinity, a kind of very sort of forward thrusting idea of what it means to be, to have a sort of revolutionary masculinity that Xi, I think, has become increasingly associated with in recent years. He's talked in more recent years about how he thinks that very specific sort of thing that actually that came up, sort of boy bands in China sort of moisturized too much. And I think, you know, the implication is they look too kind of gender fluid. He wasn't quite saying that in 1989, but the idea that actually manliness would have manifested itself in not letting things take their course, but, you know, standing up and pushing back with violence if need be, that seems to be the sentiment that's very much evident from what he said at the time.
So in the late noughties and in the early 2010s, Xi reaches the top of the Communist Party and the top of the power structure in China. Can you just tell us how he gets to the top of the Communist Party?
Again, the real story of that will have to wait probably to some far-off day when Chinese Communist Central Party archives are opened up to researchers, and that will be a field day if it ever happens for historians. But that hasn't happened yet. But we do have some indications, because until now, until the period of Xi Jinping, for the most of the period since the 1970s, there's been some indication of who the next leader would be closer to the end of the term of the previous leader. And that became more institutionalized in the 90s and 2000s, when the norm came about, a norm that was, you know, busted by Xi Jinping, that top leaders would do two terms, 5 years plus 5 years, 10 years total, and then up and out. So Jiang Zemin had to leave office in 2002, even though he wanted to stay. Hu Jintao, his successor, had to leave office in 2012, even though I guess he probably would have liked to have stayed as well. He was a very low-key guy, so it's hard to know exactly what Hu Jintao would have wanted, but, you know, never mind. And Xi Jinping came in, and as we know, is still very much there today. But an indication in each case was made as to who the next leader would be. And, you know, late into Hu Jintao's term, the name was floated of Xi Jinping. How did he get there? Why him? We don't know in a definitive sense, but various things have emerged, you know, sort of smoke signals that suggest what was going on. First of all, we mentioned this term princeling before, and the idea went around, and I don't know quite why it would be so much in people's minds, that because he was the son of Xi Jinping, who, although a kind of very hardcore guy in terms of his personal relationships, was actually, I mean, liberal is too much. You can't really call very many people, if anyone inside the Communist Party, liberal in a meaningful sense. You could call them, maybe Hu Yaobang, but even that, you could call them moderate, perhaps. You know, Xi Jinping was not the most hardline, hardcore type in that sense. It seems that maybe some people thought that, well, his son, who had not been particularly prominent or ideological in his rise to the top, he'd very much gone with the market socialist reforms, been a sort of competent, very competent leader in Zhejiang, you know, all seemed to be kind of fairly mainstream, that he'd be a bit peppier than Hu Jintao, who said very little in public about anything. But, you know, chip off the old block. Dad was well known, well respected, had, you know, lived well into the reform era. And Xi Jinping's mother, by the way, is still alive today as we speak. Last time I've been checking on a daily basis, but, you know, I think within the last few months, certainly she was still with us. So, you know, the parents within this close-knit ecology of Chinese communist leadership were known. And the feeling was, well, yeah, you know, let's put Xi Junior in. I suspect there was no knowledge or indication at that time of quite what a radical and ruthless leader he would be. I'm guessing that if they had known that, they might have had pause for thought. And the reason I say that is that there was a parallel at the time, very well known at that moment, now slightly forgotten, but worth remembering, Bo Xilai, also son of a legendary communist leader, Bo Yibo, also very ambitious about getting to the top. But unlike Xi Jinping, Bo Xilai committed a sort of fatal error, one part of which was to be very flashy and noticeable in his rise to the top. And second, although we still don't know the full details, it appears in about 2011, 2012, that he tried to sort of wrest the levers of power and failed, you know, in his coup and was arrested and still remains in jail, I think, today. Xi Jinping would never in, a million years have chosen to go down that pathway. He kept his head down, moved up and got himself into the pole position and waited till he was absolutely solidly in power before really seizing the reins of power. So I think his peers, or his, not even his peers, but the kind of generation that raised the cadres to the next level of leadership, thought they were getting one thing and actually ended up getting something else.
And can you tell us how important Xi's war on corruption is to his rise? Is this something that's rooted in an ideological perspective, or is it merely a cynical tool for outflanking his political rivals?
I think it is both something that's genuinely felt and something that is an extremely powerful weapon in terms of his rise to power. From his earliest days, certainly months, Xi Jinping made it clear that he was going to have an anti-corruption crackdown. I think this didn't raise too many eyebrows at first, because every leader coming in has had a period of anti-corruption crackdown, and then it lasts a few months, maybe a year, and then back to normal. That didn't happen this time. It started, and this time not only did it carry on, but it was even more institutionalized than had been the case before. Now, just to understand that in the minds of certainly China's middle classes and the kind of, you know, lower level elites, the previous 10 years, 2002 to 2012, under Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao, were regarded as a time when China's economy had continued to thrive, but in which corruption had got out of control in many parts of China, particularly Shandong province, apparently was notorious as being particularly kind of bribe heavy. So a lot of people were and are today, in the present tense, quite glad about the idea that there was this massive top-down, you know, hammer pushing back against corruption. And it has created an institution which still exists today, the CDIC, the Central Discipline Inspection Commission, which is basically a kind of anti-corruption super organization that can arrest people without warning, hold them incommunicado, and look into dubious cases. But it also proved to be an absolute boon for Xi Jinping, because he could use anti-corruption mechanisms and accusations of corruption, many of which I suspect were entirely justified, we don't always know, but, you know, it seems not unlikely, against political rivals. So Xu Caiho, who had been, you know, one of the senior figures in the military, was arrested very early on in Xi's time. Or Zhou Yongkang, the, you know, Politburo Standing Committee member in charge of internal security, really big, important, powerful job, suddenly arrested. So these cases, and then there were, you know, endless numbers of them, would keep going and going and going. And I would say that more than a decade later, a kind of finger in the wind assessment that you get from most people in China in these areas is that China is much less corrupt in a kind of day-to-day taking bribe sense at the official level than it was 10 years ago. It's also much less institutionalized in another sense, in that much more happens according to what Xi and those around him want. And that also entrepreneurship has been hit, because ironically, although there was huge corruption, it was linked to fast economic growth. And now a little Chinese phrase, which rhymes in Chinese, bucuo, has become quite commonplace, meaning if I don't do anything, I won't do anything wrong. In other words, it's easier to say no to signing off on that new factory or putting that new job scheme in, rather than saying yes, and then perhaps having to find that you are carrying the can for something that turned out to have been involved in some massive bribe scandal in some, you know, town halfway across the province that you never even had been to. One other element, I'd say, on anti-corruption that might be worth noting: popular culture in all societies is quite a good way to sort of take the temperature of what's going on. And it's notable that not one, but two of the biggest hit TV series in China during Xi's time so far have been anti-corruption dramas. For British listeners, or actually international listeners who like to watch British dramas, so BritBox in the US or whatever, Line of Duty, you know, sort of anti-corruption cop shows. These have been very big in China, two in particular, one in, I think, 2018 called Renmin de Mingyi, the name of the people. And then more recently, 2023, Kuang Biao, The Knockout. These were both huge mega hits on Chinese TV and in streaming about how corrupt officials were brought down. Now, the fact that the state allowed these stories to be told and broadcast on TV was also a sign that they were confident enough that the anti-corruption campaign would resonate with people. I would add as a coda that the one thing that social media suggests that the party didn't expect was that in the most recent of those series, Kuang Biao, the knockout, when polled is not the right word, but when asked on social media which character people most found sympathetic, it was in fact the dodgy official, the corrupt official, who was regarded as the most sympathetic and likable character in the show, which is not quite what I think they expected in the censorship office. But nonetheless, corruption and anti-corruption, whether it's in real life or as part of that kind of popular culture associated with what Xi's era is about, very, very central to the regime's self-perception.
I'd like to turn now to some of the changes that Xi has introduced since he has been General Secretary and President. How has he sought to transform China and its role in the world?
Essentially, you just need to look at the language to see what Xi is doing. He has talked about China's Da Fu Xing, the great renaissance of the Chinese people, sometimes with a bit of a ironic wink. Outsiders or even insiders have translated this as making China great again, with a nod obviously to the Donald Trump MAGA project. But it's not a knockoff of the American project at all. It's very much indigenously driven from within China itself. The way I would characterize it, if you're looking at it from a Chinese perspective, is in some ways, it is the final manifestation of something that really became first evident in the late 19th century, which was the idea that what China should really aspire to is a phrase, Fu Guo Qiang Bing, rich country, strong army. The same phrase was actually used in Japan at the same time as well. In other words, the idea that an ideal China would have huge amounts of economic prosperity and a very strong military to make sure it could never be invaded or occupied by foreign countries, Japan, Britain, you know, wherever, again. And I'd say that, you know, phrasing the rich country, strong army, Fu Guo Qiang Bing, is where Xi Jinping is seeking to take the country. He's not doing it the same way as the emperors of the late 19th century would have liked to, but failed to do. But he is doing so in a way that suggests that China, having been essentially a country that was forced to take orders from others for much of the early 20th century, finally kind of regained its standing after 1945 and then after 1949 with Mao, but nonetheless is a relatively weak, relatively poor state. Now that it's wealthier, now that it's globally central, it must not only stick to that position, but continue to rise and eventually become the single, you know, most important actor in global politics. And that is the direction which I think Xi Jinping thinks he is taking China and chooses to concentrate on.
So would you say that he's almost reverting to a pre-communist understanding of Chinese statecraft and China's place in the world?
No, I would say that the project that Xi is undertaking is a profoundly modern one. This is the product of someone who is trained in Marxist-Leninist precepts and mentions them quite often. It's not always evident that he's talking in Marxist language, because when there are translations done, because in the Western world, for the most part, we don't tend to talk in Marxist theory anymore. When, for instance, in a speech a few years ago anyway, Xi talked about the need for struggle, he was translated as the need to fight. And people say, oh my gosh, he's about to invade Taiwan. But the term struggle in this sort of douzheng is actually a Marxist term that's used in Marxist-Leninist theory about, if you want to get into it, the Hegelian dialectic and the way in which thesis and antithesis come up against each other to create a synthesis and go through sort of cycles of history. Now, this isn't the sort of thing that you get anywhere outside probably, you know, the senior common room of Red Brick University in about 1975 in the West. But in China, it is still part of the theoretical modeling that's very, very much part of this idea of what a modern China is going to be. Are there aspects of the past that Xi Jinping's China has chosen to emphasize? Absolutely. I would say probably the most prominent one is that unlike Mao, who rejected and despised traditional Chinese culture, Confucian thinking and so forth, Xi has embraced pre-modern Confucian thinking, very much adjusted, of course, for the modern world. It's not, you know, the thinking of Confucius as of 2,500 years ago, but he uses terms such as glorious or fine traditional Chinese wisdom to talk about it. So there are nods to the past, but the model is very much one which is about being a proud, powerful, strong nation state with its own ideological formation. That sense, actually, though, of, to use another good Marxist word, contradiction between the modern and the pre-modern, comes up in a subject which actually, again, is very little monitored outside China, but is actually in intellectual circles still something of a point of argument, which is how far is modern China shaped by Confucius and how far is it shaped by Marx? To the extent that a couple of years ago, there was even a TV series called When Marx Met Confucius, which literally had actors playing each of the those figures with sort of massive fake beards, going over five episodes of kind of philosophical debate about which bits of Chinese politics fitted with which philosopher more. So this is an active argument, if not exactly kind of on the street corner or on a day-to-day discussion, nonetheless within that wider sort of ideas lab that sits at the heart of the party thinking. We're rich, we're successful, but who are we and where do we go next?
And in this respect, does Xi's worldview mark a significant break with the visions and policies of his immediate predecessors or not?
No, I don't think it does in terms of his immediate predecessors, meaning from Deng Xiaoping onwards. I think it is different from Mao, and I'll say why. I don't think it's that different from Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, because essentially what they all did and what China still does is to argue that China is a socialist country. It is working in some abstract sense, maybe towards communism in the future, but it's not there yet. And a mechanism which must be used to get to that outcome is markets. So they've all embraced the market one way or another, and Xi Jinping certainly doesn't reject the market either. He could hardly do that considering he's in charge of the world's second biggest economy. Mao was different. Mao did very radically and explicitly reject what he regarded as those trappings of capitalism. And he also believed in kind of internal self-regeneration through radical popular violence. You know, he regarded violence as a good thing in and of itself. To be fair to Xi Jinping, I'm now racking my brains to see if I can think of an example. He uses violence in terms of repression all the time, as authoritarian leaders do in many countries. He hasn't, as far as I can tell, ever made statements glorifying it. That is not true of Mao. Mao frequently and openly and in a very kind of enthusiastic way glorified the idea that violence could be a transformative force that was necessary, you know, killing peasant landlords, you know, that sort of thing, to create a better society. Xi Jinping, I think, would not be the kind of leader who would articulate that sort of thought in any explicit kind of a way, even though, as I've said, the means of violence that the state has are considerable. And again, to be fair, if you're comparing kind of one, maybe a low bar, but considering the levels of violence in China during the Cultural Revolution, although there is much violence in Chinese society today, it's not at that sort of level.
And I want to ask you now about the corpus of Xi Jinping's speeches and writings that have been collated and published as Xi Jinping Thought. What is Xi Jinping Thought? What does it consist of? You know, what are its main features?
It's quite hard to say because I don't think there's ever been a very explicit attempt to try and regularize them into precepts, you know, like a little red book of Chairman Mao's thought. And I think that you could put together quite easily bullet points as to what Mao thought about a whole variety of things. As I've said, the idea of revolutionary and violent transformation of society on a class basis. There are probably other things too, but, you know, I'll give you that one as a sort of off the cuff version. I don't think it's quite so easy to do that for Xi Jinping, partly because, again, Xi Jinping thought itself, you know, we don't know, but I assume that what it is actually is people sitting in places like the Central Party School in Beijing, you know, with jam jars full of tea leaves and kind of lots of Changhong cigarettes being chain smoked while people put together these precepts. I don't think they're necessarily coming directly from Xi Jinping's own sort of personal preferences and thoughts on a kind of day-to-day basis. Inasmuch as we have a vision, it seems to be one in which the kind of security of the Chinese Communist Party as the engine of destiny that has driven China up to, you know, this point of prosperity, second biggest economy in the world, second biggest military, global influence and prominence, will continue to provide that sort of transformative presence. But I would say that, you know, there is relatively little there that is so distinctive that you'd want to associate it with, you know, something particular to do with Xi Jinping. And I think that's different from Mao's thought, which you can often quite clearly see is traced to particular events and ideas that shape his life. You know, essentially, his early period in the Peasant Revolution, Second World War, the Civil War, there aren't quite those milestones, I think. I don't think there are sort of reflections from Xi about, you know, when I was, 23 and doing this, that, the other, then, you know, that would be what I learned from this particular incident.
So is it quite hard in many ways to draw a direct line between the formulas set out in speeches and in Xi Jinping thought and China's behaviour on the world stage over the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, it's not an instruction book, I don't think, no. I think it's fair to say that China spends a great deal of time in ideological discussion and political discussion. There are think tanks all over the place. Party School, as I've mentioned, is a place that, you know, a lot of this sort of thinking goes on. But I don't have a sense that Xi Jinping thought as a body of detailed writing is something that's used in that particular way. Unless you have an example, Jack, of where someone has actually sort of pulled it out and said, you know, this is on page 34 where we, you know, advocate this, that, or the other. I haven't seen that kind of reaction to it.
No, I was just wondering what your view would be, because I was obviously reading through Kevin Rudd's on Xi Jinping, where he makes an argument that actually there is an ideological mission here. There is a correspondence between Xi Jinping's ideology, which is Marxist, Leninist, and nationalist, and how China has been behaving on the global stage over the last decade.
So I would say that if you want to look at the way in which debates take place around Marxist theory and its implications for China's behavior, Xi Jinping thought, and those volumes are not the place to look. You want to look at, for instance, at things like Qiu Shi, the theoretical journal of the Party School, where debates take place about what the meaning of particular ideas are. But yes, no, Kevin Rudd's analysis, I think, is entirely correct, but it's not really based, I think, I mean, in his case, it was based on the sort of extensive reading of large numbers of documents from inside the party. But the sort of published selections of Xi's thought, I don't think very many people, as far as I'm aware, would pull out quotes from Xi Jinping in the way that people even now sometimes pull out quotes from Chairman Mao. The other day I heard Donald Trump talking about, I think, Russia as being a paper tiger, which is a great Maoist phrase. I think you'd be quite hard-pressed to come up with a specific line from Xi Jinping, which is a sort of political aphorism, if you see what I mean.
But in terms of the broader worldview that you have mentioned in this Marxist, Leninist, nationalist worldview, what kind of policies have come out of that? Should we see the Belt and Road Initiative, for example, as an outgrowth of that worldview?
Well, first of all, the Belt and Road Initiative isn't really one thing. And in some senses, it's a purely pragmatic thing because China, having, you know, recapitalized after 2008 in the global financial crisis, had basically got large amounts of capital that could no longer be allocated within China, started exporting it elsewhere in the mid-2010s. And the phrase Belt and Road Initiative emerged as part of a kind of packaging of that particular initiative. So that was partly pragmatic circumstances as well. I'd say that, yes, it certainly indicates the idea that state influence over private sector deployment of capital is something that fits a Chinese model, which pushes back against the idea of what I guess they would call a kind of neoliberal idea that market mechanisms rule first and the state should really get out of the way. The PRC does not believe that the state should get out of the way. The difference is, of course, these days, the United States doesn't believe that either, actually, and is very keen on the idea of state intervention. That doesn't make the United States a Marxist-Leninist entity, as far as I know, but it does suggest that idea of a sort of state capitalism on a globalized scale as being something that China would regard as a benefit of the system that it's developed. And yes, the idea of national rejuvenation, both in terms of cultural pride, economic success, and perhaps a stress on collectivist over individual values, can be attributed to precepts that come from, you know, the party's history and the way in which Xi Jinping has chosen to have them articulated for the 21st century.
And I just wondered, is there ever a danger that we might overemphasize the role of ideology in what China is doing, what Xi Jinping is trying to do on the world stage? You know, are there also just pragmatic elements to his policy? Is he in some ways merely fulfilling the logic of China's economic rise and geopolitical position?
I think there is a danger not so much in overemphasizing ideology, But in having a slightly caricatured idea of what ideology is, I think people, you know, partly because we until recently perhaps have lived in a non-ideological age in the West, have tended to assume that ideology means sort of terribly rigid Marxist-Leninist or other precepts that are banded around in kind of obscure theoretical fashion. Ideology is a way of giving framing to what you do, which often is very, very pragmatic. You know, market capitalism is an ideology. That doesn't necessarily make it ineffective, but it's certainly a way of thinking about how the world works. I would say that that's really what ideology means in this particular case. China has a vision that the world should be a certain way, that China should have a prominent role in it. And the reason I think in particular that Marxism is relevant is that they have brought it back as a means of understanding how world historical progress emerges through various stages of clash and conflict that are then resolved, giving way to the next stage. Not in a literalistic sense, but in the sense that, you know, in a phrase that we've all used, you know, the world doesn't seem to make sense anymore. We can't work out what's happened, you know, since last week. Well, China doesn't choose to be in that position. China chooses to find a framework that actually helps it to explain why that's happening. And for China, as a country that's engaged with Marxism in a very active way for nearly a century, that is, I think, a framework to turn to, just as, you know, even though it's becoming very frayed in many ways, many Western countries would still turn to the norms of liberal democratic politics as a means of trying to explain what's happening and what might come next.
And where does this vision leave a new world order in which China is rising in influence? And where does it leave China's relationships with the United States and the West? What kind of interactions and what kinds of connections would she ideally like China to have with America and America's allies in Europe and Asia?
I think right now, as we speak in early 2026, my strong sense is that China is benefiting by not doing very much. And I think the visit of Keir Starmer to China, or the visit of Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, a few weeks ago, would be seen by China as an example of how it's redefined itself as a sort of central actor in an existing global order, which China doesn't choose to break up, but does choose to adapt to its own purposes. I think in terms of the wider goals, China would advocate for its own role as a global influencer. I think that means a different thing depending where you're sitting or standing. If you are in China's very large backyard in Asia, this will, I think, mean a growing sense of wanting to have economic and military dominance in the region. And to answer your question about the US, I think the Chinese goal very evidently is to exclude the US as much as possible from the Asia-Pacific space. If you think about the global situation, I think that influence is much more likely to be economically phrased or constituted the further you go from China itself. So I would say that the fact that, I mean, let's take the recent rendition of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, you know, huge, flashy expression of what America can still do when it put its mind to it. And that's certainly how the Americans have, you know, put it forward. Don't mess with the US. But if you look at the infrastructure of Venezuela, not so much in oil, but in areas like, you know, 5G cloud computing, China is still very much embedded there, as it is through large parts of Latin America, also in large parts of sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia. In other words, if technology is going to be the front line of the battle for influence and power in the world of the 2030s, China, I think, thinks it is sitting very pretty in that particular area. And in terms of ideology, I don't think there's any chance, I don't think it would work, for China to export its own domestic ideology around Confucianism or, you know, Marxism-Leninism, whatever, to the wider world. And I don't think it's seeking to do so. What it is seeking to export, with increasing success, is a vibe, what you might call an authoritarian vibe. The idea that, look, actually, economic benefits is what you need. You don't want to spend time, you know, messing around all this sort of civil liberties business when people are starving. The idea that there needn't be no incompatibility between personalized rights and dignity and being able to eat is not a combination that China is going to push forward. And linked with that, the wider idea that you can see, you know, if you ask some, you know, middle-class Indians what they think about the competition between India and China, they'll quite often say, well, we should be more like China. You know, maybe we should crack down a bit more and we'd be richer and more technologically advanced. Now, personally, I don't think this is a plausible outcome. But the fact that the authoritarian vibe in China, at least in some cases, seems to have at least, you know, people who are curious about whether this might work better, that works very well for China, at least in terms of giving it more credibility in the world, as the world itself seems to at least be at the moment turning away from the kind of more liberal aura ethos that was true, say, 30 years ago, to one where globally the trends are, just as an objective observation, in many cases, much more towards an authoritarian turn.
And does Xi see China's relationship with Russia as being part of an important sort of authoritarian vibe, if not an axis ranged against the Western-led world order? Or is his approach to Russia far more pragmatic and self-interested than that?
I think he values Russia, and as far as we can tell, Xi and Putin do actually genuinely talk quite often and have a sort of rapport with each other, which is real. And so I think it's not just pragmatic. I think it's fair to say that China values Russia as another sort of actor that will push back against Western influence. I mean, that's one of the other areas. There isn't that much cultural congruence these days between the two sides. There was more in the early 20th century when a lot of Chinese revolutionaries were very influenced by Russian and indeed Soviet thinking. Less of that now, but I would say that certainly the kind of affinity at the very elite level between the two sides has something to it. In the end, I think that neither side would go beyond, they talked about a friendship without limits, but that actually kind of died down quite quickly. There's certainly plenty of cooperation in areas like tech, fossil fuels, and so forth. But I would say that overall, neither one feels quite enough affinity with the other to make it a genuine sort of meeting of minds across the societies, even though the two leaders, I think, actually get on quite well at the moment. And clearly neither Xi nor Putin, I think, has any intention of stepping down anytime soon. So that dynamic will continue to matter for quite some time.
And finally, how do you think Western countries should seek to navigate their relations with China under Xi Jinping? You mentioned that we've seen the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer travelling to China this week, and it follows on the heels of Friedrich Merz, the German Chancellor, Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada. How should they seek to reckon with this worldview that Xi holds?
I think the main thing I'd say is maybe not them personally, but certainly those who advise and around them, spend time trying to get to understand it. I would say considering the centrality of China to global order in the present day and the fact that, you know, the economy in China may go up and down a bit, but it's not going to go anywhere. I mean, China's not going to go anywhere. It'll be very important for a long time to come. The level of analysis of China is in some ways very, very thin. If we think about, you know, the obsession even now that we have with American politics, you know, it does help that it's English language, of course, and also it's got lots of colorful characters. But Chinese politics actually has lots of colorful characters, too, if you know where to look. It's not that one should know everything about China, but I think we could afford to know something more about China than we necessarily do. For instance, the kind of real economic dynamism that exists at the city level or the province level, which sits in stark contrast with what may be painted with a picture of, you know, seven unsmiling men in black suits sitting at the top of the Politburo. Or, you know, I just mentioned in passing a Chinese television program or a couple of them, which I thought were relevant to one of your earlier questions. But how many people in the West actually sit down and watch Chinese TV shows to find out what millions of people are watching every night? It's not impossible. We've trained ourselves to watch Korean TV shows, after all, and really enjoyed them. China obviously is, you know, a place that produces under much heavier conditions of censorship, but it's still very interesting what comes out from China. And spending a bit of time trying to sort of get inside, you know, that collective culture, I think would be a very useful thing for those who want to engage with China to do, not least because when, as is the case quite often, we will have to push back against aspects of what China wants to do in the world, understanding where China's coming from and what are the right ways in which to explain why we take a different view is always much better done from a position of knowledge than from a position of ignorance.
Now, it would be remiss of me if I didn't ask you about Taiwan. How important is the issue of Taiwan to Xi? How committed is he to restoring Taipei to being under Beijing's authority?
I think, in as much as we can understand, you know, what is basically a series of public statements, that he's serious. Xi Jinping has certainly raised the subject of Taiwan much more than his more immediate predecessors has done. And there is a sense out there that he feels that if unification can happen on his watch, then, you know, he'll be one of the big three leaders of the modern era. Mao, Deng, and Xi would be his aim. There are, of course, a whole variety of things which stand in the way. saying you want to take Taiwan is one thing. The reality of whether it could happen, you know, if there's American military support, the island itself, you know, is now a liberal democratic state that has free elections in which people have repeatedly voted for parties to say they don't want to get closer to China. Now, obviously, a military attack could countermand that, but it wouldn't be the best look for a country that claims that Taiwan's compatriots, you know, have their kind of destiny of being reunified with their brothers and sisters on the mainland. If you have to bomb them into submission to doing it, that doesn't look great. So I don't doubt Xi Jinping's enthusiasm for the idea of Taiwan unification. The question of how it's achieved, I think, is much, much tougher. And I wouldn't be surprised if behind the scenes, there are people in China who are very keen to say, look, this isn't so easy. In that context, you know, we should spend a moment just to think about the quite recent firing of Zhang Youxia, the vice chairman of the Central Military Commission, who was one of the last senior Chinese officials with combat experience. He was in the Vietnam War, the China-Vietnam War of 1979. It was thought, maybe wrongly, that he was one of the few people who could sort of speak military truth to power to Xi Jinping. Maybe he did. Maybe that's what got him into trouble. I have no idea. But certainly the question of how a reconstituted military would be used in dealing with Taiwan may become a more urgent matter in the near future as well.
And finally, Rana, given everything that we've discussed today, how would you define Xi Jinping's worldview and what do you think his legacy will be?
I think that Xi Jinping is someone who believes that above all, the Communist Party must continue to rule and control China with absolutely no dispute, and that any means, including coercion, certainly must be used to keep the party in power. He is not someone, I think, to liberalize. And I think that he is also determined that China must become, well, it already is one of the most powerful actors in the world, but maybe the most powerful. I'll use the word powerful because I think that his idea of power does encompass a number of different domains. Of course, military power, but also technological influence, economic, geoeconomic power, and actually cultural power more and more. The idea of China as a kind of tastemaker, a rainmaker in the world. I think he wants to do all of that. I think he is a Marxist in the sense that he sees a sort of historical inevitability, and he believes that China is riding the tide of being in the forefront of that historical inevitability. I think he believes, rightly or wrongly, that the West is in decline, that China is rising, and he uses recent events to bolster that worldview. I think, though, that he's also someone who is very conscious of the revolutionary history of China. He sees himself as the culmination, but also the inheritor of that century or more of 20th century Chinese history, you know, when he grew up in the early years of the Mao period up to now, as being a sort of inexorable, again, quite Marxist view of how history moves from stage to stage, and sees himself very much at the heart or at the head, perhaps you might say, of that historical progression. Never underestimate the importance to Xi and to those around him of what they draw from modern Chinese history and how they use it as a way of indicating what China should be in the future.
Rana Mitter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jack.